has worked for the last 10 years in a hospital, community hospital, in Indianapolis, Indiana. And he tells me that because Kitty lives in California, that they split their time between Indiana and California. And I'm not sure that I don't know really what that would be like. Yeah. But we're glad that you're here, Mark.
Well, thanks.
That you're willing to share with us on the social and emotional determinants of health.
Thanks. Thank you. Hello. Did everybody have a good lunch? Okay, good. That's important. I'll try to...
Before you get started, may I just make one? I am going to be leaving for a short time because I have a presentation in another seminar, and then I will be back. And Dr. DeWitt Williams, the Director of Health Ministries for the North American Division, is going to stand in my place.
And make sure I don't go over. Well, good. Well, thanks, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. When I was given this topic to speak on, it was actually called the social determinants of health, and I've taken some liberty to put the word emotional in there. Certainly coming to Switzerland, where the WHO resides, and being fairly familiar with certainly the most recent publication of a commission paper on the social determinants of health, that's a fairly daunting task if you've ever had an opportunity to look at that particular publication and to talk about it in 30 minutes. Not to also say that if you didn't have the chance to see Sir Michael Mahmat speak, he certainly would be considered the foremost expert in that area. So I will be taking a little bit of a different track, if you will, specifically not from from the social determinants of health, putting a little bit of a twist on it, and hopefully making it much more applicable to lifestyle, which I believe this track is falling under. I'll also specifically speak from a very, very clinical perspective and hopefully give you some application from that particular context. As you walk out of here, hopefully there are things that you can utilize that will be helpful in the context of lifestyle change, as well as the determinants of lifestyle change. As Fred was mentioning, I currently work in Indianapolis, Indiana. I'm a graduate of Loma Linda University, and my graduate degrees of a Doctor of Psychology as well as Public Health, and a Master's degree in Exercise Physiology. So that's my platform that I speak from, and may give also a very indication of how I present this information. So today's agenda, we're going to start with some definitions and confines. Go to behavior change, talk about that, and motivation, adherence versus compliance as well, and then talk a little bit about the actual social determinants of health, and then speak about the arenas of health determination and influence. And if there's questions and discussion, I'm not quite sure we'll have that in this format, but we'll give that the best chance if we can. So initially, starting with some definitions. Now, certainly there's lots and lots of definitions, but I thought that this would offer us a way to at least gain some common ground in terms of being able to understand and communicate. So disease, one offered definition of impairment of normal state of function of the body as a whole or any of its parts, the actual physical pathophysiological process which can cause an abnormal condition of the body or mind. Illness pertains to an individual's psychological awareness of having a disease, can refer to a person's perception of their health. Now, this is a very, very important distinction, particularly when you're talking about behavior, lifestyle, and change in that context. So therefore, a person without any disease may feel unhealthy and believe they have an illness. A person may also feel healthy and believe they do not have an illness, even though they may have a disease. And you can see this in context of certain chronic illnesses, particularly heart disease, where one may not particularly notice any particular symptoms at the time, be going along fine, and then all of a sudden have some type of left arm pain, chest pain, or other severe or significant particular incident. So the WHO's definition of health. and I think this was mentioned the other night at the World Health Organization, is health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. And I believe at the talk the other night, the World Health Organization, also there was a gentleman, I don't remember his name, he was from Germany, he was a physician, and he had asked, and I think had also offered, why wasn't there the spiritual word in this particular definition? And I thought it was a great question, as well as an interesting way to also define. So let's define social. If we're really talking about social determinants of health, this is an adjective definition of it. Well, it's of or having to do with human beings living together as a group in a situation in which their dealings with one another affect their common welfare. Or of, for, or involving friends, companionship, or sociability. Offering material aid, counseling services, group recreational activities, etc., to those who need it. Living or associating in groups or communities. So the determinants of health. When we speak about the determinants of health, and more generally, I'll speak about it from the context of trying to understand it in two different ways. We're going to speak more specifically on an individual basis, but I want to also give you a perspective from a much larger context. So to explain health disparities, one must focus on the determinants of the disparate health outcomes across the population. Disparities are a combination of inequities and differences in population health. Inequitable health outcomes, they refer to the access or and or distribution to resources that promote good health outcomes. Differences, those are outcomes that are the result of biological risk or other factors that are not policy or barriers to access. So an important distinction here is to make between the inequitability and the differences. It's, one relates to the policy dynamics of health determinants and the other does not. Differences and disparities may have different determinants requiring different forms of intervention. This is a critical understanding because if we do not know how to define what we're actually trying to measure and determine what is affecting health, it's going to be very difficult to understand where to intervene, not only, and how to intervene. So population versus individual. Population level of determinants, expressed as rates, averages, and distributions of population characteristics. On an individual level, individual household income, education level, behavioral, hereditary, and genes. So when we speak of more of lifestyle context, we're usually thinking on an individual level. It has been shown that population characteristics affect health outcomes independently of the characteristics of individuals. So if you look at this report from the WHO on the context of social determinants of health, this is the significant theme in it, the understanding that there are greater social elements that are affecting the health other than if people are smoking and so on and so forth, or exercise, things along those lines. The three primary types of determinants have been suggested by a particular study in the American Journal of Public Health. Number one, there's distal determinants. These include policies, underline, highlight that word, policies that affect social conditions, that actual social conditions and policy-making bodies that determine policy. Rates of obesity in America, HIV in Africa would be an example of this. The second level, or intermediate determinants, place in which distal effects are experienced at the community neighborhood level. This level is the link of how the environment affects the individual demographics and risk. And the proximal determinants, the more individual based. This affects the individual's ability to respond. Examples would be the exercise, tobacco use, sexual behaviors, cultural beliefs, hypertension, cholesterol levels, and so on. So, when we talk about on an individual level, which I will absolutely and again kind of emphasize here today in the context of lifestyle and lifestyle change and the determinants of it, we think of behavior as well as change. And so when you think of behavior change, it's two different words and they have two different meanings. So if we look at this list up here, can you determine which ones are behaviors and which ones are actually change? So the first one, to exchange, substitute, or replace something. Do you think that's a behavior or do you think it's a change? If you think it's a behavior, raise your hand. Do you think it's a change then? Yeah? Okay. It is. What do you think? To exchange, substitute, or replace something? Change. Okay? To pass or make something pass from one state or stage to another? Behavior or a change? Change. Right? The actions or reactions of a person in response to external or internal stimuli? Behavior. Good. The way in which a person, organism, or group responds to a specific set of conditions? All right, that's what we want happening. The way that a machine operates or a substance reacts under a specific set of conditions. I heard behavior. Anybody for change? Yeah. So change. Absolutely. But you can see, and the reason I kind of do this, and I appreciate you kind of participating here, is really that it starts to kind of create this, wow, is that a behavior? Is that change? And we use this word so synonymously with lifestyle, behavior change, lifestyle change, all these kind of factors. And they are very different. And that's important, again, to understand in the context of intervention and trying to have an impact in terms of actually making a difference with folks' behavior. So, the ominous motivation. Why do people or why don't people do things that we ask them to do or you suggest to do or education offers them to do or policies try to get them to do, so on and so forth. And I find not only in my clinical practice, which is about 80% of what I do in my current work life, that this is a significant dynamic to it. Okay? So I wanted to give it a little attention. So we think of motivation, we think, well, here's some basic concepts of it. So if we think of the views of motivation, there are primarily trait-centered view, which is individual characteristics. And remember, again, when we think of those three different types of determinants, this would be the more proximal type, right, on the individual basis. So then we have the situation-centered view. This is motivation determined by the situation, the actual environment itself or that particular situation. And then there's the interactional view, which is a combination of the two. So in self-determination theory, a psychological, if you will, thought in terms of trying to understand why people do what they do or don't do what they do, autonomous, this is a chosen and emanating from oneself, internal perceived locus of causality, a very fancy way to saying that you feel like inside that this is something that you want to do, you've personally attached to it. Controlled, this is experienced as pressure or coerced by some internal a personal force, external perceived locus of causality. The most powerful example of this is when, if you've ever worked with individuals, groups of individuals, communities, and you're suggesting that they may exercise more, stop smoking, lose weight, change their dietary behaviors, etc., etc., and you find that they may do that for a while or you have some impact, but then it just fades. And you only need examples such as weight loss programs, if you will, that have relatively about 10% success on average, that what happens that the majority of people will regain the very weight that they have lost. And so why do they not sustain these behaviors? Don't they know they're important to their health? And so this is incredible in terms of the expectation. So sometimes I'm asked to come to speak to physician groups, and the physicians will ask me, well, we just want to know, how do we get the patients to do what we ask them to do? Why don't they do that? Because when I tell them they have diabetes and they need to watch their diet, they need to take their insulin or medications, they need to exercise, they need to check their blood glucose sugar levels 3 times a day, let's say, and they just don't do it. They come back, I ask them, and they say, well, I tried, but I just wasn't very successful at it. The physician walks out of the room, or the healthcare provider walks out of the room, pulling their hair out, saying, I don't understand why they're not doing this. And the expectation that what we know from the research, that by suggesting or telling someone to do something, it can have an impact on their behavior. It can sustain the behavior for a while, but it has been clearly shown not to do it over a long period of time. So the actual intervention is not going to meet the expected outcome. So if you're suggesting or promoting information to people, it's helpful, but the expectation that there will be long-term sustained change with it for the majority of the people is not realistic and likely not to work. Not until there is more of an autonomous personalization to why they're actually doing the behavior. And one of the areas I work in is in the behavioral cardiology, where I'll see a lot of folks that have recently come into a phase 2 cardiac rehab program that have had some type of cardiac incident. And typically, I will see them somewhere within 3 to 4 weeks post that particular incident. So when I see them, they are extremely motivated. They're jogging in place, seats and eating nuts and berries, saying, "I'll never smoke again." So they're extremely autonomous in their behaviors. But what do you think happens within the first 6 months of the very behaviors that we suggest they do in a cardiac rehab program? They stop. The data tells us that 3/4 of the folks in that particular type of intervention will stop doing the very behaviors they were doing within 6 months. So even though the autonomous behavior may be very high initially, it can fade without the nurturing and the development of it. So autonomous behavior related to positive mental health, better adjustment, greater cognitive flexibility, and enhanced creativity. So how do we build this? How do we get folks to kind of build motivation? How do we get them doing things we want them to do? So both situations and traits, remember, motivate people. People have multiple motivations for involvement. It could be why they're participating in the activity. They usually have more than one reason why they're doing that. People have competing motives as well. People have shared and unique motives, and motives change over time. The expectation that the same motive is there when you initially work with groups of people, individuals, that that's going to be there a month later, 6 months later, a year, is not a realistic expectation, will likely change. So when we speak about motivation, it leads us, of course, into adherence or compliance. And so I like to distinguish between these two because I think there's a very important distinction. When we think of compliance and versus adherence, compliance can be defined as the act of complying or yielding to something. So a lot of times we use the vocabulary, the people aren't compliant, the group isn't compliant, so on and so forth. Whereas adherence can be defined as the act of following closely or without deviation, implying a more collaborative approach to care, a partnership between the patient and the healthcare professional or group. Okay? So a critical distinction, again, between what we use as compliance and adherence, and again, these words are interchanged, they're seen as synonymous, but they are very, very different. So I would suggest to you that the use and the attachment to adherence is a, so to speak, better path. Factors influencing adherence. So what actually influences why people keep doing what they're doing or not do that? Okay. Now again, this will relate more to the proximal elements or individual elements of determinants of health or lifestyle change and adaptation. So the complexity of the regimen. What are you asking people to do? So if you ask people to do one thing versus two versus three versus four versus five things, so if I split the room down the middle, I said this half of the room I'm going to ask them to do two things by tomorrow, and this side of the room I'm going to ask to do five things. Where do you think the best success will lie? On this side of the room or on this side of the room? With the two, right? So it just seems kind of, yeah, that's how it works, logical, and it's absolutely how it works. But in most contexts, when we come into working with individuals or groups of people, the assumption is made that they're actually ready to change their behaviors and that there's no context to the complexity of going through that. So the regimen may be modified over the course of disease and depends largely on patient being overwhelmed by what you're suggesting and requires active attention to factors, again, as the diet, exercise, and medication, and et cetera. Inadequate knowledge and skills. Well, this typically comes through education. This could come, obviously, on large, large scales that we can inform people, groups of people, large populations, and on an individual level. So inadequate knowledge and skills absolutely can be a barrier to adherence. Social support. Well, there are reams and reams and reams of data on the impact and the power of social support in the context of change and health in general. So social support specifically related to family cohesiveness, family conflict, feelings of being alone, isolation with the disease or illness, and the frequency of supportive and non-supportive behaviors. This is a critical barrier to adherence and what may impede people from adapting to behaviors and, so to speak, sticking with them. Economics and personal time. Of course, finances will impact it. Now, this will be seen more on the larger scales and spoke about in the more social determinants and the more kind of distal dynamics of determinants that you may hear the WHO speaking about in a much more larger perspective. So the economics and the policies, people's personal time. If you ever worked with individuals or groups of people and you ask them why they can't or they haven't adapted to a change that you're suggesting or trying to get them to do, they'll suggest they don't have the time to do that. Maintaining lifestyle changes in context to preventing or delaying long-term complications without noticing any concrete benefits. Well, this is a fancy way of saying that when you're doing things with folks, they don't see any benefit from it, they're not going to continue. Okay? Physician-medical team relationships. So the relationships with the healthcare providers with the patient can make a significant impact on the patient being adherent to what you're suggesting. So not only is it the support of the individual that we've suggested, but it's also the type of relationship you have with them or your group has with them that will make and impact their adaptation to what you're doing. Increased stress. Well, stress in and of itself can have significant impacts on behavior on many, many levels, not only in the context from an emotional context, a physiological context, but from a behavioral context. It will impede, derail, stop, certainly at minimal influence behaviors. Emotional instability. We spoke in, if you've heard some of the other lectures, speaking about some of the other powerful dynamics and social determinants of health, as depression being one of them. A significant impact or emotional instability, whether it's depression, anxiety, other forms of, if you will, psychopathology, could be significant barriers to adherence. Non-personal information. Well, what I mean by this is this relates a lot to how healthcare providers or groups interact with people they're trying to get to change and adapt to behaviors. If one, when speaking to someone, does not include personal information, a conversation about that individual, what their name is, who they are, a little about themselves, in the delivery of information, it is likely to go right over their head or right through one ear and out the other. And the likelihood that that behavior will be adapted to diminishes significantly. So just the little bit of interaction with people on a personal level, the inclusion, whether that's for a 5-minute interaction or it's for a 2-hour interaction, will make a significant difference. Denial. This is a big component to adherence and utilized a tremendous amount in terms of trying to explain why people don't do what they do. They don't understand the importance of it. They don't understand the impact of it. They just don't realize what's actually happening and how this will be negative in their life. Well, that's because of lots of reasons, and one typically is chalked up to, well, they just are in denial. They just won't accept what's happening. Well, in some instances, that's true, but by and large, denial is a coping mechanism. It's a very effective coping mechanism. Unfortunately, it does not work over the long term. It is effective only in the short term. So eventually, we have to have and work with individuals in the context of transitioning from that type of thinking style. So the determinants of health, focus to the individual. Here's the list that basically you'll find in the WHO report and a distinction from the two in terms of focus to the individual versus focus to the more larger social context. So if you look at the list here, income, social status, social support, if we've mentioned, education, employment, social and physical environments, life skills, biology, health, child development, culture, health services. Very, very individually based, but also you want to think of these on the context of the proximal component of the determinants. Now, as we look at more kind of the larger scale, the more public policy, the more distal kind of determinants that I mentioned earlier in the lecture, you'll see lots and lots of similarities, but you want to remember they're in a different context of how they're impacting and determining people's health and affecting their health. And again, you'll see some similar, some different. For example, food security, different kind of description, housing, income, poor social safety net, different social exclusion, unemployment, early life, education, employment, gender. Even though you'll see lots and lots of overlap here, if not exactly the same list, there is a very clear distinction as you look at this list between the distal determinants, as I've talked about earlier, and the individual impact. So the social determinants of health, looking in a more broad context, is societal conditions that affect health, as well as conditions that potentially can be altered by social and health policies and programs. We look in terms of the main social categories. There's social institutions, culture and religious, that we're here meeting about. Faith-based organizations, a very, very powerful way, obviously, to impact health and the determinants of health. Economic and political structures, of course. Social interactions, relationships, and surroundings. So the levels of social determinants of health. We've spoken again about the individual that I've primarily emphasized here, the local and community, which tends to be linked specifically to the individual, and the societal at a larger. So as we think of the more proximal, which are the individual, the local and community, which are the more intermediate, and the societal, the more distal. So we have to gain the common ground about how we communicate in terms of affecting and impacting the determinants of health. Whether it's in a larger societal context, it's in a community or neighborhood context, or it's on an individual context, it is critical that that common communication is there. Hence why I've even offered initially just definitions of where to start creating a different type of communication and a common one for that. So I will end there. I appreciate your time. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. I think we're going to be speaking, have a discussion at the end of the program today. So if you have any questions, I think we'll be able to field them. Thank you.